we have arrived at the portion of our program called Tantra Studio on Planet Waves FM. My name's Eric Francis Coppolino, in case you're listening to this as a standalone broadcast. I've promised to offer my definition of Tantra every time I do this segment of the program so that we have an understanding of what I mean by that word, because it's used by a lot of people to mean a diversity of different things, sometimes involving sexuality and sometimes seemingly not. But I think that at the center of even all of those seemingly not conversations about Tantra is a sexual idea. And the sexual idea that I bring to the notion of Tantra is that it is the study of existence from the standpoint of sexuality and sex, or the study of existence using sex as a metaphor. So there's lots of examples for things that become studies in existence using metaphors, like geology, for example, is a good one. Music is a good one. Astrology is a fantastic one. Herbalism is a fantastic one. All of these things, when taken in their full spectrum, are actually studies of whether it's the life of our planet or our lives, our history, told through the metaphor of some physical substance. And in the instance of Tantra, the physical substance is sexual feelings, sexual ideas, and sexual experiences. And there are a few things that define something as Tantra, as opposed to some more ordinary or conventional framing of eroticism. And one of them is the emphasis on taboo. And so there is a modern concept of Tantra that it is about some form of relational purity that happens between a man and a wife, and it is all very upright and acceptable to society. The thing about actual Tantra is that it goes in exactly the opposite direction and is about the exploration of the things that society considers wrong or sinful or lustful or in some way transgressive, but does not generally talk about. And I am talking about only experiences between consenting adults. There's many ways to explore taboo between consenting adults, because what the rules and strictures of society have a way of doing is placing all of these regulations on what consenting adults can supposedly do. So you end up with, even though everyone's of perfectly legal age and mentally competent and not inebriated or anything like that, then there's rules about age differences, generational differences in some way being inappropriate. And if that's not enough, then there's differences in income level, differences in caste in Indian system of Tantra. And so when we get into Tantra, we get into the testing the waters of what seems to be immoral, defined as immoral with no good reason other than social control, or in some way offensive, basically, to someone else. And so when you're looking for Tantra, that's the place to look in yourself, where you have those feelings of like, oh, that can't be right. Oh, well, but what about that? You know, but that. How inappropriate that a man of that stature has a relationship with a woman of that stature, or whatever the case may be. And this translates into our workplace rules and strictures, where supposedly people of differing ranks in the workplace, you know, an upper middle manager and a lower middle manager can't have an affair, relationship, go dating, get married, or whatever. And I will concede that there has been some progress made. Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough are married, as far as I know. They began married to other people as on-air presences. They were just a kind of a broadcasting team, and wound up, you know, life went on, the years unfolded, and they fell in love working on the air every day, 5 days a week, and got married. There was a time not that long ago that both of them would have been fired by the network for having some form of a romantic relationship. So in some ways, these rules and strictures are changing, but there's always some new rule. There's always some new shade of, well, you can't really do that, and that's really not appropriate, and you can't do that. And one of the current strictures is talking about sex, right? You can do almost anything, but you can't talk about it without making people real uncomfortable and also without risking being accused of wanting sex. So this is the typical hypocrisy where everyone is basically pushed into the Madonna horror complex now, where you have to always seem like you're not interested. We have to play this charade out where you have to be super cool and never bring the topic up. And it's kind of like a game of chicken. Who is actually going to bring it up first? Who's going to mention it first or yield to their temptation or whatever it may be? And there are, again, some ways that society seems to have progressed, and there are some ways that I think we're regressing into this ridiculously childish level of reality. So I'll tell you a story of a fairly recent episode in my life. I'm involved in various shades of community in my area, and maybe 6 or 8 months ago, met someone that I really liked, and went to a series of events and noticed her a few times and met her many times and had some experiences doing some programming. So it wasn't like a strictly romantic attachment that I was attraction that I was having. It was a social, friendly one, and I asked the person out to dinner. I sent an email and said, hey, why don't we have dinner and talk? And it was not I had no specific intent in doing that except to hear where the person was coming from, to just get a feeling for who she was, right? And she agreed to have dinner, but then she tried to get me to say that, she asked me whether I considered it a date or just dinner. So I saw where she was going with this, and I refused to fall for the horns of that particular dilemma, because I drew her out a little bit, and what she said was, well, you know, I have a partner, boyfriend, whatever, and I just want to make sure that your intentions are not I'm not sure what, you know, drag her off like by the hair like a caveman or something. And I refused, even though I like her, I'm attracted to her, I refused to commit to that one way or the other and say, for example, oh, okay, let's just have dinner as we're having dinner as friends. Don't worry, this is nothing to do with romance. Or, yeah, I'm really into you. I think you're hot, and I love your style, and I think you're an interesting woman, and I want to learn more about you, and I don't really care the situation in your life. I assume you'll make the choices that are right for you. And this stuck with me a long time. And the dinner never happened, and I would not go along with the I'm a taken woman, therefore you must treat me in your own mind a certain way. And remember, there was no come on here. There was just like, hey, let's have dinner. Now, if that's a come on, I don't know, then what's not a come on? Completely ignoring someone? And I've thought this through many times, and I understand, I understood what her position, which was that, well, you know, I have a boyfriend, and therefore you can't consider yourself potential candidate for being my boyfriend. But I'm wondering, and boyfriend, in her mind, in many people's mind, is a form of marriage, right? Committed partnership. And I'm just like wondering how we got from the, hey, let's have dinner, to I must commit to not being sexually attracted and not being interested in a committed partnership before dinner. This is what I'm getting at. The whole series of assumptions in her transaction, when I made no such intimations. Now, you know, maybe she could tell that that I was into her, but why would I ask her out otherwise? I mean, I'm not you know, working with limitless time, nor limitless opportunity, and my intent was to actually just hear about her life and hear about her. Maybe that's so unusual that no one knows what it is anymore. But what, and I may be overthinking this, but every man that I know has been accused of just wanting sex. And I think this is part of the just wanting sex accusation or issue. And the difference between we're just going to have dinner as friends or it's going to be a date is obviously about sex, right? It, you can say committed relationship, boyfriend, this, that, and the other thing, but it's sex or not sex. And the assumptions involved in that are so many and so convoluted that it's almost painful to think about them. And one of the assumptions is that men are the one who want sex and women are the one who don't want sex, who have to be in some way romance persuaded or have property rights claimed over them in some way, and that they don't necessarily have a choice in that matter. So what was irking me through this whole transaction was, you know, are you implying that if we have dinner and I haven't committed to whether this is merely a friendly platonic thing where I'm not interested in you in that sense, does that just mean that if like I didn't say that and we had dinner and I was interested in you, that would just be it? You'd automatically have to do whatever I wanted? Like, why do I have to sign? Why do I have to sign off? And what if you're the one interested in me? Am I supposed to say, well, I'm not, oh no, I'm not really interested. And then it turns out that you are interested and then somehow you make yourself available. And then I have to be a hypocrite. I have to be the one who's just like super playing it cool. Right? And I think that that this is a real scourge in particular for a lot of men of a certain age. I think from talking to young guys, now that I'm, thanks to my Subaru oil consumption test, long since passed by getting out of the house every day a few times and finding, like going and finding people to have conversations with besides in my apartment with canines and plants and the internet, I'm learning that it would seem that for the younger set, for people in their let's say late teens, early 20s, the relational sin is being interested in a relationship, meaning conversations, right? Not necessarily getting married and hooking up and signing up for the full package, but conversations where there's some form of evolving trust, and the thing quickly exchanged is sex, i.e. hookups, but don't take an actual interest in the woman herself. That seems to be in from what I'm hearing, kind of off the table. So things have switched, and it is the older generations of guys, not really generations, but even slightly older, who and I'm sure the younger guys are going to hear this sooner or later, but that all you're really interested in is sex. And I think that this is inherently hypocritical on its face. I think that we're all interested in sex. We're all attracted to people. We're all attracted to more than one person. I think that the notion of accusing someone of being interested in sex is on its face hypocritical, because everyone is interested in sex on some level, and if you're absolutely not, people are going to know, and that's it. So I'm talking about the ones who are just socializing and experiencing one another, and in any way expressing, you know, basic curiosity. And it's difficult to know what to do about this. There's a whole branch of theology from the pickup artist movement, so to say. Really not a movement. It really starts as a book and becomes a kind of genre of Reddit, and is a favorite whipping boy of feminists. Is that men who study and understand the psychological triggers that get women to drop their guard and want to have sex with them. And I have made a careful study of this, and it all to me seems on the up and up. You know, the conversation starters, how do you conduct yourself socially in an environment? What do you do when you're in a group environment? What do you do when you're in a one-on-one environment? What do you do when you're a man approaching two women, you want to talk to one of them? How do you keep the conversation going? There's all kinds of various things. You learn a couple of magic tricks, keep them in your pocket. You keep some photos in your pocket. Maybe that's a little bit old, but, you know, it would still work. And you learn how to read tarot cards. And anything, it's all social. It's all, how do you keep the conversation going until you get to the secret ingredient of the pickup, which is negging. And the negging is the carefully placed insult, the left-handed compliment that gets a woman to want to prove herself to you, which plays into a number of things: her potential lack of self-esteem, potential daddy issues of wanting a man's approval, and generally the sense of not being taken seriously, and then wanting to assert oneself. And then one of the ways that assertion can be made is by a sexual assertion by the woman. And in doing a careful and thorough review of this all, it to me all seemed like legitimate social maneuvering. How do you conduct yourself in society till the point of negging? And that seems to be, if you, you know, look at the literature and read it, it's stated outright. And so that's the manipulative part. I don't think it's manipulative to use various devices to start and continue conversations. I don't think it's manipulative to dress better. That's a big pickup culture tells the guys, look, go out looking good, keep your teeth clean, get rid of the ugly glasses. You know, look presentable, all that, be polite, on and on and on. Don't be intimidated, learn how to be rejected, all this stuff. This is all fantastic. Remembering, of course, that we are in socially still in kind of Victorian times, where men are expected to do all of the approaching, and therefore to bear the brunt of continual rejection, right? And this is a burden being passed to men. And men know they're in a double bind, where if they don't make the approach, if they don't assert themselves and be a man, very little is likely to happen, and they're not likely to be respected in any way. For you know, in there, you need to show some alpha to get the attention of woman generally, some leadership, some assertiveness, and at the same time, they risk being accused of being inappropriate or coming on to someone in an inappropriate way. And I think that this all has to be sorted out. I don't know, sorted out and some new agreements come to. I don't know where the forum to do that is besides sharing my ideas here and holding up my own kind of standards of what I will concede to and consent to and how far I'm willing to go to in a sense play a game. And by the way, the antithesis to pickup artist books is a book published around the same time that was all getting going called The Rules. And while very few women today have read The Rules, I think many people know The Rules. And The Rules apply basically to dating. So it doesn't strictly apply to hookup culture, right? Hookup culture seems to just be its own thing because there's no social pretext. There's no attraction other than, you know, just the, you know, physical animal magnetism of that particular moment. And then everyone gets to, dust themselves off and walk away. So my phone rang the other night and it was a woman, who's like, it's like 10 o'clock at night, you know, so it's, usually you don't call people randomly at 10 o'clock at night. I'm almost always up. So I answer the phone and turns out someone who's like, I'm not sure you remember me. It was a long time ago. We hung out and didn't seem to really end well, or maybe you just brushed me off. You brushed me off. That was what it was. And so on and so on. But I want to thank you for all of your work on COVID because it's kept me sane and all of that. And turns out that, you know, soon into the discussion, I got the, you know, in addition to all the gratitude for the enormous work that my team and I are doing and not having ever slept in 2020 and all this stuff, that I got the all you're interested in was sex. And it took me a minute to remember the encounter. It was 5 years ago. A lot has happened in those 5 years. Like, you're the person who you were in town and you went from thousands and thousands of miles away. Me being me, I said, well, sure, you can stay in my studio. Now, I want you to know what an act of trust that is, because my studio at that time, Blue Studio, was my primary place of business. So all the business records were there. The computers were all there. Huge amounts of equipment were there. Financial records. And it's my art space, my personal space, and all that stuff. And I trusted this person enough to give her my door codes and then be social with her the entire time. And I'm thinking, oh, that was two days. And so two dinners, and I think one that I cooked and maybe one that was out. And we acted out your favorite scenes from my dinner with Andre. And you got a private rock concert, and that was cool. And then the endless, hours long, ask me anything about astrology and the neighborhood tour and no sex. And all I was interested in was sex. Has that ever happened to you? So I don't even think there was, maybe there was a conversation about sex. I mean, people do know that I'm a place where they can come and have a conversation about sex that they're never going to have before. But that wasn't the conversation of what sex we were going to have. It was whatever it was. I don't even remember. It was so long ago. So my friend Rob is a record producer, and he's also an electronics inventor. He's come up with all kinds of interesting devices, and he's pretty good at it. And the other night, he called me up and he said, "Hey, I've got a new thing that I think you should try. I think you really like this. It's called the CFD. It's a Cunnilingus Fantasy Detector. And he said, you know, it can tell you what people are thinking, and it works over remote distances, and also can go far back in time. So he sent one of these things, and FedEx came the other day. It was obviously a hand-built prototype, a little retro-looking with rabbit ear antennas and a one-page instruction sheet. And so I thought I would try live on the air to see if this thing works. I haven't worked it yet. I'm going to aim it in the direction of this person. So anyway, let's see here. I've got this sheet. It's this old school Xerox copy. Turn the thing on. Let's see what we've got here. All right, it's warming up, and see if I can get adjust the antennas to Okay. All right. Okay. Wow. Wow. Really? Wow. That's impressive. Wow. That's pretty hot. That's what you were thinking? Really? Who? Again? And again? Wow, who's that? Is that your boyfriend? He's there too? Okay. Looking at that, that's a very imaginative. Wow. You've got a dirty imagination. You're my kind of girl. Wow. Really? Okay. That's what you were thinking? That I'm so why didn't you call me up? Anyway, there I learned a little something. It would seem this would call for a more enlightened approach and maybe not accusing one another of the things that we all feel, the basic sensations and desires and curiosities that we have. It is this kind of garbage that drives people apart from one another, and it plays into the moralistic approach that society is now taking about basically everything. Everything is now considered both a disease and a moral issue. And the forces that have been attempting to, let's say, squelch the human experience and throw cold water on all of our feelings almost always do so first by waging purity campaigns. And the purity campaigns are almost always about hygiene and sex. And it's easy to trigger people's genital anxiety by conflating morality and disease. This is what all of the drama around sexually transmitted infections is. It is anxiety projected onto the genitals. Now, I'm not saying that STIs don't exist, but I'm saying in almost all cases, it is merely anxiety. People have pretty good hygiene these days. Most people go to the doctor and get, you know, their basic tests done and know where they stand. And I think from what I have seen, the incidence level of these things is relatively low compared to, for example, what it was in the past. And yet the morality conflated with the physical health issues is not seen as the, you know, I guess the word is red herring, the thing that is there to completely confuse the issues, basically, and make sure that people are caught in their own fear no matter what, at all costs, and feel bad about themselves at all costs. One of the things I've noticed from studying the history of sex is that depending on the era, the century, the decade, sex is always blamed on someone. Usually, it is one of the sexes. For a while, women are the cause of all sex. And then that slowly changes, and then men are the, you know, the lustful demons who are the cause of all sex. And then that changes for a while, and then it's the women who are the lustful demons and the cause of all sex. And this keeps getting passed back and forth over the decades without anyone having much memory of when, well, you know, now guys are blamed with everything and every guy's a potential rapist, whereas just so many, not so long ago, so many decades ago, it was women who were the uncontrollable, insatiable, lustful nymphomaniacs. The other way that the blame for sex is passed on as a moral issue is that in most people's minds, and again, I don't really quite exactly have this sorted out with, let's say, the young set in their mid-20s and below. And this is an age groups I have relatively little to do with at this point in my life. I did when I was a photographer. I heard a lot about my models' sex lives and their lives with their boyfriends. But in older people, the ones who are kind of the relationship mentality, there's always someone who is more perverse than you. And that's how you protect your status as the one who is less perverse. So one example of that monogamous people can congratulate themselves because polyamorous people are more perverse than they are. And it's completely unacceptable to most people who preach monogamy that anyone would be out of the closet about having multiple committed relationships or multiple relationships where the people even knew what was going on. In other words, where they weren't completely secret. And so I've always thought that the taboo there was about revealing one's truth rather than the basic biological and social fact of being polyamorous. The polyamorous people have long held, and I don't know, maybe this is going away, that swingers were more immoral than they were. They were the ones really immoral. We're polyamorous. We're not swingers. Those swingers, all they want to do is go to parties and trade partners and have sex with other people. It's a scene where married people go, and then based on various agreements they set, can do whatever they want. So the poly people have always said, no, they're swingers. This is we're moral. We have commitments and that kind of thing. And as far as the swingers go, I don't know who they pretty much don't give a toss about anyone, like what people might think. But the thing about swingers and people in the lifestyle is that they tend to be partnered and married. So I guess from the standpoint of swingers, the more debauched or immoral or something are particularly men who don't have partners who show up, who end up paying through the nose to get in the door of the clubs. This is back when there were clubs. I have no idea what has happened to these institutions now. So you're in swinging, you were more moral and upright if you were married and you were swinging. Well, this is my wife. We go to swing parties. And then similar things have go on in various other, shades. It was for a long time, straight people could always accuse gay people of being the more, immoral and debauched ones. Like, oh, that's the way that they live. And then gay people have had a way of projecting the lack of morality and propriety and commitment onto bisexual people who can't make up their minds about who they are and what they want to do. And still, I think that there's an unusually little, where is there any discussion? Unusually little discussion of bisexuality and the, you know, natural attraction that a great many people feel one way or the other for members of both sexes, even though one may dominate in some way, you know, you're more interested in one or the other, but, you know, there tends to be the gayer than gay people and the straighter than straight people, and then everyone else is kind of scattered somewhere along a few different continuums in the middle of this. And it makes me wonder what's going on, you know, why there has to be all of this complication. And you know, in some ways you don't need to look further than the Christian movement being the most damaging thing to sex in probably, you know, modern history, longer, further back than modern history. We're going to be talking all the way back to, you know, the beginning of the first millennium, taking the most anti-sex position of any religion. This is documented beautifully in a book called Eros Denied by Wayland Young. Eros Denied. You can pick a copy of it up for $3 or $4. It may be one of the best reading experiences you've ever had because it explains the process by which this happened, this conditioning and the banning of words and the banning of ideas and the hiding away of any erotic imagery, even until relatively recent times. One example that Wayland gives is the artifacts from Pompeii contained many phallic symbols, and they were kept under wraps for hundreds of years. And finally, I'm not sure when the showing was, maybe sometime in the 19th century, where they let people see all these ordinary household objects that that came out of the ruins of Pompeii and how many of them were phallic symbols. The calculated assault on masturbation, which Wayland Young does not address, but which is addressed in another book, I think called Solitary Sex by Thomas Lacker, Lacquer. It's a history of masturbation from the classical era to modern times. So, you know, Betty Dodson's in the book, and Masters and Johnson and other people are mentioned in there. And we find out that masturbation wasn't really an issue until around the early 1700s, very early 18th century, when one particular book became a very, very popular item, and it was a kind of an infomercial by a guy named John Penname, Dr. John Martin, a guy claiming to be a doctor. And this book, as I've told this story a few times, and it's you know, worth looking at the hilarious, morally repugnant language in this book, which casts masturbation to be the ultimate of all sins, and the ultimate temptation and the kind of gateway to all sex, the worst possible thing. And the book was taken in two different ways. It became a kind of a work of pornography on the street, Grub Street in London, I think no longer extant. It was a very hot item. And then it became a staple of drawing room conversation, translated into numerous languages, and taken seriously as a kind of moral tome, finally we have a coherent philosophy of sexuality, which I read in Thomas Lacker's book, led Immanuel Kant, considered one of the great philosophers of the modern era, to think that masturbation was such an evil thing, there shouldn't even be a word for it. And it was this particular work that I think, and other things in its genre, I've read other bits from that era, that dealt a kind of a really crushing blow to people's ability to experience their own sexual impulses without immediately going into a moral crisis or into guilt and shame. And so the thing that all of these things have in common, all of these, there's always somebody queerer than you so you can feel better, or anything you do is wrong, all lead back, they all kind of funnel into embarrassment, guilt, and shame. This is why working with embarrassment, guilt, and shame is to work with the very substance of the thing that is holding society down and is binding people to their sexual misery. It would all be fine if not for guilt and shame. Thinking, well, people would run wild if it weren't for guilt and shame. Well, would they? Good look at cultures where there's less of that. Margaret Mead did so and found out that actually puberty was pretty orderly in those times when girls were given the freedom to make their own choices. And notably, this always comes down to the choices that women are allowed to make and not allowed to make. And this often goes, almost always goes, completely unquestioned. And instead of any investigation into our personal truth, our actual feelings, how we feel about each other, what we want, what do men want? Do men want only sex, or are men, you know, also interested in the other stuff and going out of the town and music and reading books and this kind of thing? But any incursion of the sexual concept above a certain age, right, or where there's generational difference, is considered inherently wrong and or problematic and or embarrassing and or shameful and or disgusting in some way. This is what we have to be mindful for. Now, I think the genius of Tantra is that it works consciously with this kind of projected darkness, which Jung called shadow. That's unconscious projected darkness. And it also inherently starts to question the narratives. And it's very important that you know when you're listening, when you're hearing to a narrative. A narrative is any time you think, I knew that, that story fits, oh, that's typical. You know you've got a plug and play. You're running what used to be called tapes, a script, an app of some kind, a narrative of some kind. And so one of the things that Tantra, in my view of Tantra, strives to do is to challenge all such narratives. And they're challenged with truth. The first tantric teaching that really stuck with me was William Pennell Rock, who wrote Only Truth is Erotic. That's available in an article called Jealousy and the Abyss. And I've quoted that lots of times. Somebody thought that I said it. It's ripe for me to steal because I've claimed who the real author was so many times. William Pennell Rock, Swami Anandvirajwar. Yet, if only the truth is erotic, it seems to me that the truth is what is the most taboo, and maybe the truth is the most taboo because the truth is erotic. And I have found one of the, apart from that, there's a few others that's closely related, that one of the most potent, useful tantric tools is to work with embarrassment and not against it. To go in the direction of the embarrassment, to find the concealed pleasure. Now, this is daring, and it kind of can feel to some like walking along the edge of a cliff in some way. Obviously, that, you know, might not be a pleasant experience for some. It might be a very pleasant experience for others because it is daring to go there, and there is a real vulnerability that you incur when you go there and consciously experience the things that embarrass you and or may feel shameful and or make you feel guilty and or may be guilty pleasures. And so you're in the right place. You're in the tantric space when you can be honest about your guilty pleasures and you are able to exchange feelings, ideas, and experiences in that dimension. And there's going to be plenty of people who say, well, I'm going to do all the things I don't feel guilty about, which means avoiding all the ones that they do, which fits the whole avoidance agenda of pretty much all things sexual where there is an idea or meaning or a purpose connected to it. Somehow, the mindless sex thing, allegedly the domain of prostitutes and other sex workers and burlesque performers and all those women that no one wants to fully acknowledge the existence of, is its own thing, and it's like it all can go on behind closed doors and does not exist in polite company. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So that rule gets applied a lot. But when you start to add up the ways in which this just holds everyone down, you start to see that there's a systemic issue in society associated with all of this endemic, endless, constant avoidance of the topic of the feelings, and of, in particular, the challenging feelings. And then each of these instances that I've outlined where someone says, well, you're the one who has the sexual desire. I hear they have sex. He has sex with her and her friend. They're the real weirdos, man. They're the ones who are unfit for parenthood. Oh, those people over there, they're two couples raising one child together. They're the ones we should call CPS on. Oh, that guy may be gay. Oh, this is just till like 2 weeks ago. He's the real criminal. Just for being gay, for being lesbian. And what I have seen in studying the history of sexuality and sex and the social milieus around sex is that this device is used all the time. It just depends who gets the brunt of it. The libertine woman, the homosexual man, the child molester, the rapist, right? These are all essentially figments of the imagination, right? There is no actual class category, scientifically defined category of libertine women or of, voracious homosexuals with a homosexual agenda that are going to take your son away. They're going to convert him. But all of this held to the level of religious principle. But in some form, you can always see these types of projection operating. And you have to be discerning to look for it. And then also calling it out, even recognizing it for what it is, violates the taboo to say, you can't really come to that conclusion that all men are sexual harassers or potentially sexual harassers. All men must be guilty of something. And the we have now evolved, so devolved into, in my observation, the potentially always guilty party being the heteronormative male, heteronormative man, particularly if he's Caucasian. And so the essentially the straight white guy has become the next phantom of projecting society's darkness and sexual delusions in the concept of, oh, that's our whole problem. If not for that guy, if not for those middle-aged straight guys, this would be an awesome orgy. If not for those, you know, Republican, what's the theory? The Trump supporting, unhygienic, uneducated bottles of lust. Every society would be perfectly fine. We're pure. He's dirty. Listen for that. If you're interested in tantric practice and tantric philosophy, that's the thing to challenge. That's the place where you say, wait, really? Who is that person? Let's find out about that person. Someone did was it about red pill culture? Red pill being like, it's hard to explain what red pill is because it's cast one way by the media and by academic feminism, and then it exists as a whole separate thing. I'll find this documentary, interviewed these people who were reviled by feminists for being too male. Too male. It's so crazy that I was once called by someone, a spokesman for a group, during some issue in 2018, hyper-masculine. Me, hyper masculine, thinking what, like Jack LaLanne? Like what the hell's hyper masculine? Frank Zappa? He's not hyper masculine. What's that? What's hyper masculine mean? Hyper masculine? Me with at that time I had like rainbow painted toenails and fingernails. The hell's that mean? And so, the fun of Tantra is challenging these accusations and taboos and not dwelling on them politically, because this is one of the traps, is the political trap is the number one sexual trap, is to politicize it all. And this is the main trick society is now using to shut the whole conversation down, is to politicize it. It's politically incorrect to have that conversation. It's politically incorrect to say that. It's politically incorrect for a man to ask a woman out, a boy to ask a girl out. Well, what's that about? Well, that's politically incorrect to be male. So men have a lot of claiming to do. Women have a lot of claiming to do also. If we turn that cunnilingus fantasy detector or that fucking fantasy detector onto everyone, that thing would be going off quite a lot. And all of this is, the ultimate result of all of this is to suppress fun, to suppress loving instincts, especially by saying, well, any form of sex without the concept of the committed, structured, connubial relationship with money exchanged in the bank account is immoral. Has to fit our definition. Well, Tantra is everything outside of that official definition. It is anything that transgresses anywhere there is something to transgress. And I am talking about lawful activity between adults. Anything that transgresses the norms, the rules, the bounds, the expectations, there you begin to dip your toe into tantric territory. Whenever you consider the possibility that there consciously there is something really hot about that embarrassing thing, I want to find out what's going on down there. Ah, that's tantric. Another very early idea. Highly recommended. get the people of the opposite sex around you in harmony. There are people who think they thrive on the competition of others around them. All that does is destroy your power. And so the tantric man has women around him in harmony, and this feeds his power. A woman of power, a tantric woman, has men in harmony around her. So most men think, well, I'm going to compete for this woman. Well, what about harmonizing with exactly who she is? Harmonizing with what she wants. How about that? There's a lot of potential for embarrassment in there, you know, which you'll see happen over and over again. And if you get a whiff of that, and you can arrange it, negotiate it, which you can do, and certainly in your own mind, that's where you embark upon the treasure trail of the tantric journey. That's what I have for you today. Let's go out with two more bits by Bob. Having a little Bob fest today. Did I write them down? The first is, these are from the album Street Legal. Two from the album Street Legal. One is one some are familiar with, and all Dylan fans are familiar with, called The Changing of the Guards. I love this one for lots of reasons. It was kind of a signature song in the late 1970s, and lots of fun. But if you pull up the lyrics, you'll see that you can pretty much tell the entire story of the song in tarot cards. And it begins with a reference to the number 16. The first word in the song is 16. And so when you hear the word 16, you go straight to Trump 16, the tower. And then the tower is referenced in the last line, and many tarot cards are referenced in the last line. And I know Bob is into tarot cards for a lot of different reasons, including using them as art and on an album cover and all of these references. This is followed by what I think is the most understated and incredibly beautiful song on Street Legal, and that is Señor, Tales of Yankee Power. A pleasure, as always, to be here with you. You are invited to reach out to me at any of those EFC addresses. The best ones are EFC at bookofblue.com. That's a good one. EFC at chironreturn.org. If I miss your email, just resend it. I'm very likely to see it. And long and look for any opportunity to keep this conversation going. And you are personally invited to speak about your experiences, your thoughts, your feedback, your needs, your desires, your personal tantric journey. I would encourage you to, you know, you listen to me talk about these ideas. Maybe you've got something to say. I know you've got something to say. Whether you are going to say it or not is another thing, but I'm certain you have something that you want to say about yourself and what you're noticing. All right. Once again, thank you. Bye for now.
Can you tell me where we're heading? Lincoln County Road or Armageddon? Seem like I've been down this way before. Is there any truth in that, Senor? Senor. Senor. Do you know where she's hiding? How long are we gonna be riding? How long must I keep my eyes glued to the door? Will there be any comfort there, Senor? There's a wicked wind still blowing on that upper deck. There's an iron cross still hanging. I'm around. can see that painted wagon, smell the tail of the dragon. Can't stand the suspense anymore. Can you tell me who to contact here, senor? I'm ready when you are, senor.